Welcome to Hedson's Living Histories podcast, capturing and sharing the life stories of people who have used or worked in NHS mental health services in Sussex, following the closure of the old asylums in the 1980s, up to and including the COVID-19 pandemic and its aftermath. By listening to people tell us, in their own words, about their experiences, we explore the complex interplay between mental health and a life well lived. Over the course of a year, Living Histories volunteers have recorded 35 in-depth oral history interviews across Sussex, opening up new ways to reflect on the past, present and future impact of mental health on people's lives. The full interviews will remain sealed for 80 years in the Mass Observation Archive at the Keep, housed in the University of Sussex. But in these podcasts, with the permission of the interviewees, we present some of their memories, experiences and reflections for the first time. You might find some of the stories you hear challenging, as participants talk openly about the difficulties of living with mental ill health. Please be aware that topics including mental health crisis, suicide, abuse and neglect are covered in these episodes. Living Histories celebrates the strength, courage and resilience of people living with mental health problems and those caring for them. Our huge thanks to everyone who told their story. The episode, A Different Kind of Life, asks us all to consider, what does it mean to live with mental health challenges? This episode documents the lived experience of service users in Sussex as we explore the role that mental health plays in life and how we shape our worlds around and in response to it. We consider how NHS staff support people to live with mental health challenges and the impact that caring has on clinicians' own mental health, as we highlight the very fine line that divides those who care from those needing to be cared for. A Different Kind of Life gives insight into resilience, adaptation and survival as we amplify voices from those who've spent years within the system alongside people managing mental health in daily life today.
The first sign of my illness was I just was driving so badly. I was losing my confidence to drive. I got halfway between Bognor and Worthing one day and I stopped the car and I couldn't move. Nobody knew what was happening. My husband said, I'm going to Lally. I didn't understand it. But when I went to the B-Dale and they said, I've got depression, I said, no, I haven't. I've got a good job, I'm running my house. I haven't got depression. Well, you have got depression. I said, no, I haven't. Didn't know anything about it at all. But looking back on it, that's what happens to you.
There's always something. If it's not the train, or it's not kids crossing the road, or it's not... The other day, I had a better... Going up to the Sussex County Hospital, on the bus, get to the first stop, the 7 bus out here, stops at the lights, showed him my OCD car on the bus. He was lovely, the bus driver, yeah, okay. There's a whole, like a caterpillar of kids crossing, with their teachers all crossing the road, because they couldn't all get across. Now, that's quite normal. I had to get off the next bus stop, and I'm really, my foot's hurting, and my back's killing me. Walk back, check up the road, up the drive. No one there, it's quite safe, because I knew they would be. But I had to do it. And I had another one on the way back, coming back, I had to check again. And I get home here, and I'm on my knees checking. And if I don't check, I'm ruminating, then I'm thinking about it. And it just goes on and on and on. It never lets you go.
It was just like being in hell. I felt I had insects crawling under my skull. My legs didn't belong to me. The water was being poisoned. The other patients were terrifying. There were so many different hallucinations I had, I can't even remember all of them. And it went on for at least 6 weeks. I had a sketchbook with me, which I can't find. And I drew, and all my drawings, I wouldn't use a colour, black or red. And it's really interesting now because I've trained as an art therapist and those colours are representative of trauma. So that's what I did to cope, and I did that pretty much all day.
I only really understood mental health when I was in my 30s,
and I had an allergic reaction to my epilepsy medication that I just got put on, and then I had my first episode of psychosis. That's when the conversation really started about, it wasn't even mental health, it was being mentally ill. So it kind of jumped the whole mental health conversation, and it was now just, you're mentally ill and we've got to deal with that.
When I became ill, I was quite high up, and I thought, I'm damned if I'm going to hide this. And I was in charge of the whole section, about 20 people. And I went in that morning and got them all together and told them, I'm mentally ill and I don't want you to hide it. And that you can talk about it openly, don't go around whispering about it. They tell me it's something to do with my chemical in my head. I don't know what it is, but I'm off for 6 weeks and I'm not hiding it. I never did hide it, but I never was able to go back and work anymore.
I took a big overdose and then passed out in the rain on my back under a hedge, so I ended up inhaling a lot of water. I woke up with my father trying to convince the nurses that they should shave my dreadlocks off, and them saying they couldn't because it was my autonomous right to have them. All I have to say is the staff all the way across the board have always been so, you know, they do save people's life every minute of the day just by being there.
I mean, there's no doubt at all that my life is very different from the way it would have been had I not had the lump in my head and the associated mental health issues. I've met, of course, a lot of other people with similar lumps in my head, as you do when you get this. And I've been able to support a lot of people, which I'm pleased about. My life would have been very different otherwise, but I'm not saying it's worse now, it's just different. Unfortunately, for many people, it is worse. And that's part of the reason I'd like to see the change of attitude, because people want a life, they just don't want to be maintained as, yeah, kept out of hospital, yeah, true, but kept out of life as well.
Disability is a very, very personal journey. I've been very privileged to find a group of people and find a way through, which has largely been kind of positively affirmed my sense of myself as a disabled person. For the majority, I guess, it's really not like that, you know, because if you go into a workplace situation, if you talk about having a mental health issue or any kind of impairment, then you're immediately under a sense of judgment. The lack of awareness and understanding is just mind-boggling at times.
The worst mental health I've had in my life was probably around about 1976. I was pretty bad, but I didn't know it was mental health. My family didn't know it was mental health, so I never got any treatment. I didn't see a doctor or anything like that because I didn't realise I needed to. It came about because I tried to be a religious person and it didn't work out. You've probably heard of people calling themselves a born-again Christian, and I did that, but it just didn't work. All the things that they'd said would happen for you didn't. You know, I've never had a prayer answered in my life, for example. I didn't get the experiences that people said I would get. And I didn't know why, and they didn't know why. And when I bounced out and said, no, this isn't working, that was when I was really bad. But I thought it was a sort of spiritual problem. You know, maybe I was 200 years out of date, because 200 years ago, all sorts of people had spiritual problems, were put in asylums. Not so much these days. I just felt huge despair. Your hope's gone, as it were. Your social support is gone because I've left the fellowship, and it just meant I was very much on my own, completely not understanding what the hell was going on, because that's not the way it was supposed to be.
was part of the service. Because of my social anxiety, I was put in contact with a nature-based charity called Grow. And I did lots of volunteering with them eventually. Not at first, I was a participant. But that massively changed my life, because when I had social anxiety, I was very keen to just essentially run away and leave Brighton. And I just saw Brighton as this tainted place that was where my psychosis happened. And then being part of the charity group showed me other areas of Brighton that I never even realised. And this is going to sound slightly crazy, but I didn't even look at the Downs until I was part of them, and it's so big and it's so popular, and I was like, how have I never... I always just went to the beach. It just made me feel like, oh, there's actually a space I can breathe. So when times get hard, I don't have to go to the beach where I feel like everyone's at. I can escape and get a bus down to the Downs and just spend the day down there.
My last job in my old career was going in to support struggling services, carrying out very complex safeguarding investigations, and then I broke.
I don't think you can work in mental health if you've got great anxieties and you're going to take it home, because you are going to see things. You are going to be working with people that may end up committing suicide. And you do see and hear some terrible things. But if you took all that home, you wouldn't be able to do it, would you? No.
Regularly, again, you know, you get staff members who are referred to us. Or very, 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 very tricky. Very tricky. You know, confidentiality issues, maybe having to see patients of theirs. These are people who were clinicians, were substantive clinicians, found themselves and had problems, and then became part of that middle ground. I myself was unwell a couple of times, seriously unwell. That was important for me, even with respect to dealing with my patient. You can read as many books as you can. You can watch as many YouTube videos as you can. You can sit and observe somebody else as much as you want, but there's nothing like waking up with that condition, experiencing the nuances of it, which you might not even think about, as to how it can affect your day-to-day life and your relationships and everything. You know, it's the realization that unless we take care of ourselves, then we cannot take care of others. And that works as well for our staff, works for our services.
What is crazy is the services not recognising or realising that they're in this vicious cycle. I'm a very expensive client now in terms of the intensive trauma-based CBT work, the medication that I'm on, that I'm going to have to be on for years. You can't have people waiting 6 or 7 months for treatment, especially when research and everything we know about mental health will tell you that you can do work that would prevent it getting so bad. You need to be able to really hear and listen to what people are saying. And when somebody says to you, I have had experience of 2 very severe prolonged depression, you take note of that. Don't ask people to recognise their symptoms, their triggers and all the rest of it, and then ignore them when they present them to you and say, these are the triggers, I'm heading downhill.
It's changed a lot to the point where I don't mention it a lot with my trainees, because it's a different landscape altogether. There is no point in telling them, but we used to do this and we used to do that and this is how we used to do it. Because in reality, what we used to do was you worked 5 days a week 9 to 5. Then when you were on call, you worked that on top of your 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. If you were unlucky and you got the weekend, then you were there from Saturday morning 9 o'clock till Monday 5 o'clock, uninterrupted. When we were doing a psychiatric training in Eastbourne, you covered A&D during the night, sometimes during the day as well. So any mental health presentations who were coming into A&D, you were the one to go and see them. Now you don't. You've got a liaison team which goes there, and at night you've got the senior nurse practitioner which go there. In a way, good, but on the other hand, that's where the action happens and that's where the training happens. There's nothing like being in A&D faced by 4 successive patients and you have to think, do I wake up my consultant or not? Because I better have a decent question to ask if I'm going to do that, because I might be working with him or her in my next rotation and they won't forget.
I would have known how to process at that age. So I definitely suffered a lot from, wasn't depressed, but I was very sad. I now know that I have ADHD and I definitely had a lot of that as a kid. So like inattention, not being able to like focus and concentrate and being all over the place and being kind of having this, like I was hypersensitive, like I was so sensitive and no one really knew how to deal with it. So I think a lot of that definitely played a massive role in me as a kid.
There were some turning points, yeah. That's when I was first under section, I appealed against my section, and the managers recommended that I start the Open University. That was the first time for many years that anyone had had any faith in me that I could be anything apart from a mental ward patient or a vagrant. And after 4 years part-time study, I got the certificate from the Open University for my first bachelor's degree. And strangely enough, when I got the certificate, it was in a plastic coating. So I was about to embark on 5 years living in bus shelters. I had this degree certificate with me, which had this protective plastic coating, and I had it in my pocket, and so it didn't get wet, it didn't tear, so I still got the certificate after 5 years of homelessness. Yeah.
I don't know what keeps me motivated. I suppose the day when I don't want to come into work or I really find it too much. Yes, of course you can have days when it's like that, but I suppose I've been in it long enough that I know how to deal with me. Maybe you might not know how to deal with all the pressures of work, but I don't have a problem with motivation. And the trouble is, because it's never going to be the same any day you come in, it's always going to be something different. Or someone's presenting you with a different problem, you don't have time to think, I'm bored, or how do I keep going? It's just there.
When I was at Rutland Gardens, there was a young man who had a checkered history. He had been in prison and he'd worked as a bouncer, enforcer for drug gangs and whatever. Had a significant history of violence and aggression, and I was his named nurse. You are wary with his history and you're thinking, okay, righty-ho. But it was how you spoke to him and how you engaged with him. He was on a, you know, home office restriction, and of course if we broke that, you know, he had to go back, and unfortunately the next time came and we had to transfer him back to forensic. And people were so concerned that the transport service asked for police presence and attendance. And so the riot squad turned up and he'd started packing. And I said, look, you know, transport's here. I said, you know, I need to know, are you going to kick off? People think you're going to behave in this way, certain way, and you're going to kick off and you're going to get Larry, and are you going to do that? He went, no, I'm not. I said, do you promise? He said, yeah. He said, I promise. He said, and I ain't got me going to break me promise to you. He said, you've never broken it to me. And he came downstairs and he walked out and he got in the transport And a couple of the police that were there knew him from before when they'd had dealings with him being the enforcer for the drug gangs and whatever. And they went, he's totally different. You must have given him something. I went, no, he's fine. Well, how'd you get him to do that? I said, because I just talked with him. I didn't talk at him.
It took a few more years for me to understand myself as having been disabled by psychiatry. My life journey has been dictated by psychiatry. Everything that I've been through, everything that I've lived, has been in some way determined by the experiences that I've had of psychiatry. You know, within the disability arts movement, within the disability movement, people talk about being disabled by society, by the barriers that society places in front of you as someone with an impairment of one shape or form or another. The way that society uses psychiatry as a kind of a way of completely dismissing and reinforcing taboo. They talk a lot now about the taboo about talking about having mental health issues and breaking down that taboo. But the caveat within that is that it's still about what's wrong with you. It's not about what happened to you to shape your kind of connection with the world. That's really fundamental. We should be asking, what's happened to you? Why are you distressed? What has happened in your life to cause the levels of distress that you're clearly going through?
You can only help people up to a point. You can't be part of their lives or be their friends. You know, it's you might identify, there's a lot of stuff there, but there's not a lot you can necessarily do about it. Broken homes or people that may come from an abusive background. I mean, I'm old enough to see the children of abusive parents who now become part of the mental health service, you know.
I've always, always loved my job. Yeah. Sorry, I'm pausing because you just start thinking about the good times we had. And it's that first feeling of realising you're having the keys and you're responsible for the whole ward with the patients and staff. You cut your teeth, you learn as you go. Every day, school day, there's not a day go past you do not learn something and see lots of things. You see life, I have to say, and it's most raw, best of life, lovely compassion, humanity, kindness. See the not so pleasant sides every now and again, but it's been a thoroughly enjoyable job.
I believe in something that is greater than us. I don't believe that it's all just random. And part of me believes that I am the one that was identified as the one to heal some of the generational traumas. It's hard to make sense because I'm not one to say, oh, woe is me. And quite honestly, there are people who are far worse off than I am or ever have been. You know, I have a roof over my head and I have a meal every day and I have people, you know, I have access to medical care and all these things. Equally, it's also hard to deny that I have probably had somewhat more than my fair share of things happening in my life. It's hard really to make sense of it.
It's a funny thing. I don't think I would change any of it. But that's the strange thing about it. And I think, you know, if someone had lost their legs, they probably would say they wish they hadn't lost their legs.
This episode of Heads On's Living Histories podcast was produced as part of a collaboration between Heads On and Sussex Partnership NHS Foundation Trust. Living Histories was funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund, NHS Charities Together and Heads On. We're deeply grateful to all the participants who shared their stories and to the many staff, volunteers and project partners who have made Living Histories possible. If you found this episode interesting and would like to hear more, please visit www.headsoncharity.org/histories, where you can learn more about Living Histories and listen to other episodes. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, support is available. Please visit www.sussexpartnership.nhs.uk/your-mental-health/getting-help. Audio production by Charlotte Petz and Michael Umney. Music by Chad Crouch. Narration by Living Histories volunteer Ian Barnett. Oral history clips taken from full interviews with project participants from across Sussex for Heads On's Living Histories. For more information about Heads On's other projects, please visit www.headsoncharity.org.